Hi, good evening, everybody, and welcome to another webinar presented by the American Herbalist Guild. We have a couple of sponsors for our webinars. Maryland University of Integrative Health is one of our sponsors. We have a slide for another sponsor that we'll show you at the end of the program. Tonight's presenter is Bevan Clare, who's the Vice President of the American Herbalist Guild, and she's going to be talking about what she's learned in her first 20 years as an herbalist. So, Bevan, thank you for giving this presentation, and take it away.
Thanks, Stephen. Well, good evening, everyone. This is exciting, and it's quite an honor. The topic is something that it took a while to think about what exactly the topic that I wanted to do. And as in my many roles that I have as an herbalist, one of the things that I spend a lot of time doing is counseling professionals, but also younger people or younger professionals, the people who really want to break into this field and have this be their way of life, and how to do that in a realistic and in a good way. And I also work with a lot of people who are, you know, teaching extensively or practicing extensively. And so tonight is my effort to kind of take the many things that I've gleaned from 20 years of herbal practice and teaching, and to try to make it useful for others. So, you know, people often are just asking, how did I get into this? How did I end up doing this, particularly at a young age? And, and I was really young. You know, my first herb classes were when I was in my mid-teens. And by the time I was a, you know, young adult, by the time I was 17 or 18, I was already teaching a little bit of herb classes and really, you know, getting out there and doing things. And I found that in many ways, you know, I had the role models that I was looking for, but I also didn't at times. You know, everybody I knew that was so good at this and so powerful at this also was like living out of their car for the first 20 years of doing it. And while I wasn't opposed to living out of my car and did a little bit of that, I also felt like this was good work, and there was no reason why we couldn't, I couldn't make a good income, you know, something that was going to support me and a family and to do this as a professional. So that's been a real goal of mine, but to not lose sight of my values while doing that. So tonight, I'm going to kind of take you through the different aspects, I think, of being an herbalist and what I've learned in particular. Some of these lessons might be applicable for you. Some of them might not be. But the idea is to, you know, to kind of put it out there, and I'm going to try to give as many specifics. This isn't just going to be like, you know, funky Facebook slogans, although if you have the slides, which I don't think you do, they are just little taglines to open the door up for what some of the details that I want to discuss. So without further ado, I'm going to start off just talking about being a clinician. I was a clinician much earlier than I was really ready to be a clinician, and probably like many herbalists, you know, I want to hide under a blanket every time I think about being a clinician in those early days and how little that I knew, and I'll probably feel that way again in 20 more years. But I started kind of a home practice when I was really young because people said, well, there's nobody else to go to, so you have to do this. I practiced in doctor's offices over the years, some kind of more alternative practices, some conventional practices, and had also a private practice. And right now my practice, since I've been having babies, I haven't done as much private practice at the Maryland University of Integrative Health, where I'm an associate professor and an herbalist and nutritionist there. But I also work as a clinic supervisor, and we have a busy 27-room treatment center that's where our herbal clinic is, and a dispensary. And so I really get, you know, my hands on there, maybe not as much as I would like to. But that's really where I am as a clinician. So one of the first things that became clear to me with herbal practice is that really as herbalists, we are working with two totally different interventions. And they're fascinating. Both of them are very powerful. You know, there's the intervention of the herbs and the intervention of the herbalist. The herbs themselves are much more of kind of a biochemical language and discussion between the herbs and the human. There's also all of this coevolution. I mean, people and plants have spoken the same language and moved in step together. We can't live without plants. So herbal medicine really harnesses that relationship that we have with plants and that connection that we have with plants. being an herbalist really harnesses that relationship that we have with people. It's very much about the human connection. And I think herbalists at their best, I always think of them as a catalyst for change. You know, the herbalist intervention is really fascinating. So really, herbalists would have two different types of training when they did this. And, you know, historically, it's hard to generalize historically, but historically, much of the herb training was done explicitly. You know, this is how you use this herb, and this is how you use this herb, whereas much of the herbalist training was done implicitly. Like, you would watch someone practice. You would observe how they made their way in the world, how they communicated with people, how they brought out their truth. And so, you know, where I work is more of a, you know, conventional learning institution, we don't do as much implicit learning. You know, a lot of it is explicit. So it's like, how do you train someone to be an herbalist? And what exactly is that? Are they just, you know, kind of a conventional doctor of herbs where, you know, they get a quick health history and check things out, or are they different? And I think they really are different. There's some pretty powerful things that an herbalist can do. I really like Peter Conway's book, Practice of Phytotherapy. I think that that's a remarkable book by Peter Conway that really looks at just being an herbalist, not really at the herbs at all. I also think that this would be an interesting place to do some studies. So if we have anybody out there who's ready to launch into a clinical trial, I think it would be fascinating to look at a study with various arms, like an arm where we're looking at herbs only. So just people that come, they say, you know, this is what's happening, and they all get the standard formulation. Or people that are working with an herbalist, and they also get that standard formulation. So let's say it's a respiratory, people that have chronic respiratory allergies or something. The first group, everybody gets the same formula. The second group meets with an herbalist, and then they all get the same formula. The third group meets with an herbalist, and they get a custom formulated formula. And the last group only meets with an herbalist, no herbs. It would be fascinating to see what would happen and what would be the most effective or what would be similarly effective out of those different types of intervention strategies. So, you know, as far as being an herbalist, a lot of what we do is detective work. And, you know, I feel like we really seek to understand the processes going on in somebody's body. And a question that I'm always trying to answer is, with clients, what are you trying to find between them and being well? Like, you're trying to find what stands between them and being well. And a lot of it happens with, you know, what is actually going on in their mind. I often do a day in the life. So I start with, okay, you wake up. What's waking you up? Is it an alarm clock? You know, whatever. What's the first thing you do? What's the first thing that goes in your mouth? You know, okay, it's breakfast time. And so I can start to see why they make their choices. I can also see the impacts of family, of culture, of their occupation. And I can see something important that is called locus of control. And it basically means their ability or their perceived ability to change the world that they live in. Do they think that they are in charge of making changes and having things become effective, or do they not? So when I'm looking at clients, one of the ways that I'm doing assessment is the idea of health. I often think of it, health, as being like a cup that's inside you, or a bowl that's inside you. And everything you do either adds to that bowl or takes away from that bowl. And I'm talking about everything, like sleep, food, movement, social interaction, spiritual interaction, all of these different pieces, environmental health and influences. And each one of these things either pours something into your bowl or takes something away. And you can live for a while with something taking a little bit away. And you can live for a while with some things, you know, compensating for each other. But as an herbalist, I'm looking for what's adding and to make sure that stays as contributing to health, and what's detracting. And how do I figure out what's detracting, and how do I stop it from detracting and start getting it to add? And so that's one of those, you know, it's something that when I'm working with a client or when I'm working with a student that's training, a lot of it is very much a line-by-line process. Is in the beginning is, you know, is sleep adding or detracting? Is there social support adding or detracting? Is there occupation adding or detracting? And then what can change? I mean, I have a 1-year-old and a 4-year-old. So there's certain things that are detracting that I just can't change. but there's also a lot of things that they're adding for me. So that's one of the ways that I'm looking at, you know, how do I assess and how do I approach a client? When I'm working with a client, my job is really to set them up for success. I'm not trying to give them everything that I have that I think is helpful. It's very much, what do I choose that I think that they are going to most likely be able to do that's going to have the biggest impact? So, of course, for many people, you know you could have the biggest impact by telling them, okay, you know, give somebody your kids for 3 months, you know, check into a Club Med for a while, read a book for for 2 weeks and just relax. Their health is probably going to change, but there's a lot of things they can't change. And so what is it that I can do with them that's minimal and that they can come back to me and say, I did this and it made a difference? Because in many ways, what you want to do is figure out what their ability to change is and stay within that. Because the more you ask them to change, the difference of the change from their current status takes more energy to maintain. So baby steps is great. And the most empowering thing you can do for a client is to have them come back and have found out that something they did helped versus coming back to you and saying, I couldn't do the things that you asked me. It was just, I couldn't do them. So setting that client up to succeed is key. Listening is also key. And when we talk, I talk with my students sometimes about what the most important thing they're going to do in a consult, and listening is that. Sometimes it's almost all people need is to be listened to. And yet we're very uncomfortable with that silence or that blank space. And becoming comfortable with that blank space is really important, knowing that you don't have to fill it, and that if somebody's crying or trying to find the words for something, you can just sit quietly and not impatiently, not with a leg jiggling, but just sitting there, allowing them to feel like when it's ready, you're going to hold that space for them and open that back up. Another way of listening is by nudging that person along with more details and also repeating back what you understand. So especially if it was a very difficult story where they were kind of stream of consciousness saying it, at the end to see if you understand it by, you know, saying, it sounds very complicated. From where I'm sitting, this is what I heard. And to repeat that back to them. And to see, and so they can say, no, that wasn't what I was trying to say, or yes, that sounds about right, and you can fine-tune it together. So listening is a key aspect of the work and the things that we can offer to our clients. I have a rule about adding before I take it away, and this is one that I found has really served me. So even when a client comes in, unless they, you know, they're ready to give something up, but they say, you know, I love my coffee, it's my favorite thing. And I'm looking at their insomnia and their anxiety and their GI issues and thinking, wow, getting rid of that coffee would be really good. But what I might do in the first visit, or what I often would do, is two things. One, asking them to tell me how, if they could go over the next week, if they could tell me how coffee makes them feel, so they could do some observations. And then the other is to give them a lot of tea, you know, 8 cups of tea a day. Hard to drink coffee when you're drinking 8 cups of tea if you're going to try to comply with that. So people will automatically nudge back their coffee. And sometimes they'll even say, you know, I really thought about how it made me feel, and by the third day I realized it really doesn't make me feel well. And so I've been trying to stop drinking it. So in the first visit, my goal is to build rapport and trust, and taking things out of people's lives isn't a good first step with that. So I almost always try to leave everything in, because whatever they're doing, it's not so harmful usually that they can't do it for another week until our next visit. So adding before you take away. It took me a long time to realize that anger, irritation, and frustration can be useful, acknowledged emotions when working with clients. That doesn't mean I'm going to start yelling at my clients. I've had moments of that, and I've known those clients for a long time. But in many ways, it's acknowledging what's coming up inside me. And sometimes letting them see that, you know, it's in as a beginner, as a clinician, you know, what you want is you want your clients to like you, and you want your clients to come back, and you want them to just stay there. And realizing that sometimes challenging people is really important. And as a teacher, this is also very relevant. That sometimes, you know, people just have to be have to be both challenged and also, you have to show them some of the reality of their consequences or some of the issues that are happening. So, you know, deep relationships aren't just cheerful. And so sometimes, you know, firing clients is something I do occasionally, just, you know, telling them that I don't think that our work together is effective, and that if they're going to come in and pay money to sit with me, either we need to come up with a different plan or they need to do the plan that I'm doing, but repeatedly not doing the plan that we agree on isn't going to work. And so, you know, allowing them to see that other part. Of course, that's not always what you want to do, and we'll talk about that in a moment. An important process that I think herbalists often forget is the clinical process, which is to assess goals and then herbs. So to take that a little slower, you know, your first step as a clinician is very much to build rapport, to have that person trust what you're doing and feel like you're listening to them from your very first contact, whether that's on your website or email or phone. And then your job is to assess them, whether that's physical assessment. It would definitely be a medical history. I mean, it might be labs. It might be getting a lot more story from what they experience. You're going to gather all the information that you need to be able to do the next step, which is to create an assessment, so to really put together a comprehensive assessment for this individual. And that comprehensive assessment talks about that contributing or detracting piece that we already mentioned. So when you look at that comprehensive assessment, looking at, you know, what are the pieces that are you need to add, what are the pieces you need to take away, and what are the things you need to support in their life. So once you do that assessment, you have a good idea kind of what's going on with the person, then you create goals. Notice we haven't gotten to herbs yet. Then you create goals. So that assessment might be, you know, as simple as this person has a very, you know, cold and dry digestive system, and is also very stressed out, you know, sleeps poorly, and has limited financial means to be able to do this, to do the herbal support. And then your goals for this person would be short term, for that person might be for them to feel like they, to feel a little less nauseous after meals, might be a goal. And then long term goals would be to have digestion optimally contributing to health. So, you know, setting these goals up, goals are not plans. So goals don't involve herbs or diet or anything. It just involves where do you want to go. And then looking at that goal, then you set a plan. So if the goal is to not feel as nauseous after a meal, and you know that this person, your assessment is that they have a cold, dry digestion, then you're going to start looking at what herbs are warming and moistening for digestion that would be well tolerated. So an herb like fennel might be a good example, or an herb like cinnamon in powder form might be a good example. And, you know, how would you use those? You could think about this person having minimal finances, so either it's going to be drop doses of tinctures or smaller reflux doses of tinctures, or maybe it's going to be a powder that they're going to use in their food or in something. So, you know, really doing that and then assessing that plan later on. But the point is, you know, a lot of times we jump from, oh, this person's like, oh, I get nauseous after meals, and we're like, dandelions. And so this is a process to go through. And it's really helpful to actually go through this process of, you know, assessing, creating an assessment, creating goals, creating a plan, and moving on from there. I alluded to this before, but the idea of knowing when to hug my clients fiercely or when to kick them gently. And I would say that just like we have all sorts of plant medicines, we have plant medicines that range from being soft and fuzzy and sweet to medicines that are very strong, that have a, you know, overt physiological impact on individuals. And so just like we know what medicine might be appropriate for these individuals, the idea is that we could also know what sort of relationship that they need. What do they need? Do they need somebody who's just going to be the most gentle, caring, loving person? Or do they need somebody who's going to give them a little poke to get off their butt and make some changes that they need to do? As a clinical supervisor, this is particularly interesting because I step into the room with 5 minutes with that client. And so even though I can get a heads up from the student, I choose a tactic when I step in. And sometimes it's the right tactic, and sometimes it's not, and sometimes it's a huge failure, and sometimes it's it worked out pretty brilliantly. So knowing, you know, what you have to work with and not being afraid to do that, to go ahead and be a little bit more prickly with your clients as you need to. So keeping up with some of the more esoteric things before we get into, you know, herbalist as an educator and herbalist as a plant person, the herbalist as an individual, I think, you know, herbalists are something. You know, we are a very broad crew of people, but we have a lot of common values. And this is kind of looking at some of those values and also some of the things that I've learned in my own life being, you know, a traveler, a teacher, a mother, and some of the extensive work that that I've done as far as stress management or self and personal growth. So letting medicine be food is such an important one. You know, we talk about food as medicine a lot, or nutrition talks about food as medicine, how, you know, all the food you eat should be your medicine. I really like the idea of the medicine that you're taking should actually be your food, and using herbs specifically as food in your life. I don't feel a need to take a lot of tinctures or capsules or anything like that when I'm well. But what I do like, you know, taking herbal pestos in large medicinal doses. I love having, you know, spicy and aromatic anti-inflammatory herbs blended into pesto that I can eat. Herbs in, like, nut butter balls. I made a turmeric black pepper fudge the other night for a crew of herbalists that had a significant therapeutic amount of turmeric in it. And it was delicious. I make soaked oatmeals where you can soak chia and oatmeal and almond milk or something or whatever dairy milk you like and add herb powders and other things like that. So it's therapeutic. And also teas, you know, iced teas, juices. So not always worrying as much about their therapeutic value as much as making sure your life is full of medicine, that your diet is full of medicine, that medicine is a way of life and a way of being for you. Knowing whose shoulders I'm standing on. I've had so many amazing teachers, you know, Rosemary, Gladstar, Seven Song, so many teachers around the world. Those teachers for me are people that have taught me, you know, a way of being. Herbalists, when I think about my roots as an herbalist, I love being an American herbalist. You know, I may not be the most patriotic person, but I love that American herbalism is this interesting blend of kind of European herbalism, which has some Asian influences, Native American herbalism, early American herbalism, and, you know, I think not significantly noted enough, the medicine of this enslaved people. You know, there was a strong African influence, particularly, you know, living here in Maryland, where we had a lot of freed slaves and, you know, just a long history with slavery. There's, you know, there was so much herbal medicine being used, and those fringes of society at the time were the physiomedicalists, the Native Americans, and the freed slaves, and there was intermingling between all of them, and it created this kind of fertile mishmash of herbal medicine, and I'm so appreciative that we have that as our herbal medicine. You know, being aware of the support of your family, your friends, your teachers, and, of course, the earth and the plants themselves, you know, acknowledging all those things I think is important as an herbalist to do that. And it'll make you feel, if you ever feel sad, you just acknowledge all the shoulders that you're standing on. And that certainly makes things feel a little bit more in perspective, you could say. I'm a big believer in intention. And, you know, again, this is kind of the herbalist as an individual section. So these are more, you know, these are all have to do with herbs, but they all also have to do with kind of launching yourself into the place where you want to be. So, you know, for me, I always knew where I wanted to go. I wanted to be an herbalist. And I didn't want to be an herbalist on the side while I was having my day job. I wanted to do this full time. And it took a few, you know, kind of fits and starts to do this. But in many ways, it was a question of daydreaming and a question of figuring out the next step to reach that daydream. I remember sending out hundreds of resumes in the mail, of course, because this was generally pre-email, and mailing out all these resumes and letters about what I did and offering to meet people for tea. And I think about the opportunities that came up from those. I probably mailed out a couple hundred resumes. One of them, I met somebody who owned a health food store in Boston, and I practiced at that health food store for a while and really got my footing there. Another one of them ended up on file at the Massachusetts College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences, and was pulled out a long time in the future when they needed a lecturer, or at least, 18 months or 2 years in the future, when they needed a lecturer that had canceled on that subject, and they found my resume, asked me to speak, and I'm still part of the Massachusetts College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences on an adjunct basis today. So possibilities can happen if you put it out there, letting people know what you are into and where you want to go. And I think that that's, an important and impactful lesson of something that we can really do. Go ahead and make money. Herbalists, there are many exceptions, but not as many as there should be. Herbalists are often, terrible money makers. They really, have a lot of trouble making money. And in many ways, the herbalism, it's really good work. If we aren't willing to make money or a living, whether it's in trade or in money, then we're kind of almost putting down our field. So, that doesn't, I'm going to get a lot about making things affordable, but, valuing yourself and your craft and feeling like it's worth a lot is really important. Even if it makes practicing being comfortable, asking for money or saying that, just doing that again and again and saying, this is how much I charge, or so on. But figuring out how you can make a living, and I should say go ahead and make a living, because it doesn't necessarily have to mean money as much as a living. But there are some other pieces around this, and I think that, you should acknowledge how what you're doing is amazing. Looks like this picture isn't loading as well as it should. So this says charge like what you do is unique and amazing, because it probably is, if you can't see that. Actually, one quick second. I'm having some quick network issues, so let me just make sure I'm connected. Okay, so it looks like we're good. So charging like what you do is unique and amazing, because it probably is. The idea is that with this is that, you really want to set your sights on a place that you feel like is reasonable. What can you do with the money that you're making? And also, how much should you be making? What is your perceived value of yourself? Considering, who you reach, that's one of the questions I always have when someone asks, how much should I be charging? One of the big things that I'm always, how much do you charge is always, are you charging for this? What kind of group is this? Is it free for the participants? Because then, I'll probably make it free too. But making sure that you're charging for what you're really worth. And I think, we aren't always as good at that as we should be. So charging for what you're doing like you are really worth it, and making sure that's key. I think when you're teaching classes, and people always ask, how much should I charge? And I would say to charge a range, and that's why, how Robin Hood did this is the way that I always do this. I've always made sure that no one would be turned away unless they feel like they don't want to do this. But that doesn't mean there's an endless, free-for-all. It's a question of, how many free consults will I give a month? And then when I run out of that, or, how much can people charge? Or can I charge so much for one population and have it cheaper otherwise? When I used to practice in Boston and Maine at the same time, and the folks in Boston would pay a lot more than the people in Maine, but it allowed me to charge a lot less in Maine because the people in Boston were paying a lot more. I had an odd situation at the Maryland University of Integrated Health where I work at one point where people could pay $120 to come and see me, or maybe it was $140, I can't remember, $140 to come and see me. They could pay $45 to come see me in the student clinic as a supervisor, or they could pay nothing and come in for free clinical services, which were also offered, and I would be there. It was amazing how many people said, oh, well, I want the good one. And it was all good. It was just a question of what you valued. So, you know, remembering how, you know, kind of Robin Hood did this in many ways and always making medicines affordable. So I think that this is also a key piece here is that, you know, as herbalists, we need to know how to make our medicines affordable. It's great if someone can afford to take 10 milliliters a day of a tincture and spend $200 a month on that tincture. Brilliant. You know, if they can do that and that's what they need, that's great. But if they have $15 or $10 a month, you have to work with them. You have to know how to use herbs in an inexpensive way. My favorite way is to use powders. They tend to be about a tenth of the cost of tinctures and about a quarter of the cost of using capsules or even less than that. So powders, herb powders, are just fantastic as medicine, and I'll get to those in a little bit. So don't be afraid to be in awe at the most simple things and share this. So that's something, you know, excitement is a major asset. Feeling incredibly passionate about what you do is contagious. You know, if you're telling people about things, they may not even agree with you, but they might be like, wow, this person is really into this. It's got to be interesting somehow. So, you know, when people aren't around excitement enough, you know, our world, we're so blasé in some ways. And getting people excited about things, allowing them to feel like you welcome the energy of them being excited like children, instead of just being like, oh, yes, well, this is interesting or that's interesting. Get that contagious excitement. Get out there and dig in the dirt and show them how powerful it is to make medicines. Get down to the ground and stick your face like right inside a flower and get to know it. And allow people, you know, teach them to wonder in nature. You know, share that with them and how much beauty there is around. I think turning the lens inward really brings us down to our roots, the idea of personal growth and development. You know, I think an effective clinician is always working on themselves. It doesn't perfect, and it doesn't mean that you need to be particularly you don't need to be, you know, in full-time therapy or something, but what you do need is to be aware of your stuff and really trying hard to work effectively on that. So I think also being aware of your biases, your culture, and your assumptions is very important. As herbalists, we tend to be, you know, part of a more alternative movement, and judging people doesn't help. So we may find that, you know, the person that drives the super big Hummer and, you know, lives in a huge McMansion that cut down all the trees is somebody that we have a lot of biases towards. I'm sorry if that's you and you're listening to this call and that makes you miserable. But maybe that's our issue. And so figuring out, like, is that our issue? Is that theirs? You know, can we still help them? You know, what does that mean? And so, you know, there's so much that we don't know about people, and really turning the lens inward and understanding that, you know, in many ways we're often looking at a mirror when we're looking at somebody. And I think that brings us to the last piece as an individual, which is really knowing what matters and sticking with it. What are your values? What can you compromise on? So you might think that there's certain things that are really important, and then you find out that they aren't so important. When I first started practicing, I was like, if somebody makes me shave my armpits, then I don't want to work with them. You know, they need to realize this is natural and this is who I am. Well, those things are true. You know, it is natural and is who I am. But when I realized how much more I could bring plant medicine to people and how much more I could connect with them if I shaved my armpits, I realized it really didn't change my values. You know, shaving my armpits didn't change who I was. That wasn't like a central value in my life. And so, you know, really knowing where you draw the line and who you are and what your values are. So, like for me, you know, I won't tolerate racism or overt sexism in my practice. Those are things that I just feel like somebody would be better off working with a caregiver who could be more compassionate to them, because those aren't values that I can tolerate. And so having values drive almost everything is key as an herbalist. You know, if we don't have our values drive us, even as far as charging and all that, and having your values dictate how you charge is actually a very significant piece of all of this, because if you value what you do, you won't feel like you can't charge what you're probably worth. So although, you know, the AHC is a professional herbalist kind of clinician group, I think there's very few herbalists who aren't also educators to some extent. In fact, off the top of my head, I can't really think of any who aren't educators at all, especially because in the treatment room, that's what we're doing anyways. We are educating people. So I've always, you know, I've been an educator as long as I've been an herbalist. I kind of learned and started teaching at the same time, just simple stuff. You know, here I'd learn how to make some medicines, or I'd kind of teach some other people how to make some medicines. And oftentimes, being a teacher is like that. You're always learning and you're always teaching. You're always studying things as you go along. And so, you know, teaching for me has kind of varied all the way from, you know, the universities that I'm affiliated with and work at, or all the way to, you know, classes out of my home, or classes at places like massage schools or herb conferences or other herb schools. And there's a million and one ways to be an educator. And you learn a lot about yourself as an educator. What I want to bring in tonight for those of you who are teachers and those of you who are students and those of you who are teachers of just your peers or your family or have schools or whatever, is that as an herbalist, there's so much you can learn from being an educator, and you should be an educator. Like, you should be out there sharing what's so interesting. And I learned so much from being an educator, for having my students for 3 years pretty full time. I remember when I first started at the Maryland University of Integrative Health, James Snow was saying to me, if you think that you can go 3 years with a group of students and they never see who you are, or you never have an off day, think again. And he was absolutely right, you know, that you know, you have to figure out all of your stuff as you go through this. So teaching about what excites you is really one of the most key pieces. And that should change, because your teaching will always be your learning. Sometimes when you have some confidence around your teaching, choosing a topic that you're desperate to learn about as something you want to present somewhere is a great thing. As long as you have the foundation to be able to learn deeper about that, it's a wonderful way. Like, let's say it's a certain part of history you want to learn about, or a particular herb that you use in practice, but you want to go so much deeper. That would be a great proposal for something you speak about. For this talk, I really wanted to think about, you know, what have I learned in the first 20 years of doing this? Like, what did I come away with in 20 years of my life that could help me to be more effective at what I'm doing for my teachers, for my students, for my clients, for my peers, and for myself moving forward? And so this, you know, allowed me a lot of reflection. If you follow your interests, and I speak at a lot of herb conferences, and I also look at herb proposals for herb conferences, like the AHG conference, it's when I see people's passions, that's when it gets to be really interesting. And I think, you know, sometimes you can see that come through, whether it's like this, you know, more of an intellectual subject that they want to speak on, or it's something that they are just really into doing. And it's the people that are really into doing something that you start to migrate to. So find your passion, let it bubble up, and you know, and also speak on what you're an authority on. If you are the biggest authority on so many subjects because of what you do, and if you're talking about your experience and your recipes, no one can really debate that. This is a tough one for the herb community, this next one, but in, you know, higher education pedagogy, we talk a lot about the idea of stopping lecturing, engage challenging, and letting students play. Flipping a classroom is the idea. So no more actually just lecturing, which is exactly what I'm doing right now, because it's hard to do it otherwise on a webinar, but the idea of active learning, giving students a chapter in a book or a monograph on a plant or something like that, and having them read it, and then when you come together, applying that information, playing with it, discussing it, and, you know, really having problem solving, helping students, you know, having them find tools and find information. This is where it really gets interesting, having them make their own medicines. So, you know, instead of sitting there and demoing and lecturing how to make herb balls, put out a bunch of stuff, tell everybody to make an herb ball in the room, and then taste what worked, and then talk about, you know, what worked, what didn't. In my experience, if you actually stop talking, give some students some information, stop talking, they often come to their own conclusions, and it's so powerful what they can learn if they're actually given the empowerment to just go ahead and figure it out themselves. Know how to properly use the primary literature for what it can uniquely offer you. You know, primary literature is not everything. You know, literature is very much, I always think of it, it's like getting the blood work and the genetic material from a client. So you haven't met the person, but you get to see the blood work, you get to see the genetic material. It's going to give you some ideas, sometimes more than that. But until you meet them, you don't know them. And plants are like that. The primary literature is not going to help you understand a plant, but it might help you to understand a number of interesting aspects. Primary literature, really, you could almost divide it into two areas. Does it work, and how does it work? And it depends on what you're interested in. You know, there's all sorts of things about whether a plant works for a certain condition or not. But then, of course, you need to know how to read your primary literature. And this is where I encourage everyone to get practice. Look at the design of the study. Look at how much herb they're using. Look at how they prepared the herb. Are they giving it in vitro in a test tube? Are they giving it in vivo, is it to humans? Are they injecting it? You know, what are they doing? And as an herbalist, you can kind of look at that and go, wow, that looks reasonable. Wow, that doesn't. You know, spend some time going to a site like PubMed. You can actually see a lot of free herb journals. You can get a lot of information that you can fool around. Going to NCAM, the National Center of Complementary and Alternative Medicine, at NIH is another place where you can look at a lot of herb papers and see what's happening. And it's a great thing to be able to understand because it's not the whole story, but it can be incredibly useful to have that information. So another piece is that I've learned as a teacher is that being a teacher or a clinician, but being a teacher isn't always the same as being a friend. And, you know, for those of you who teach a lot or those of you who have teachers, realizing that being friends, I mean, part of me wants all my students to love me and to want to be friends with me. And, you know, and I hope that a lot of them do. But sometimes my job as a teacher is to help others grow, and sometimes that's painful. And so figuring out how to do everything you do from a place of love, even if that means pushing hard on someone to change as an educator, figuring out, you know, what they might need to do to be able to serve more as an herbalist, and pushing them and questioning them to do that, even if it means, you know, risking your friendship to make sure you're a more effective teacher. Cultivating people's passion is my primary goal in teaching. The idea is to open the doors for students. They might not be excited in what I'm excited in, but helping them shine a light on their passion so they see it and they can find their own unique joy. That's what herbalists do. I mean, that's what you should be doing with your clients, too, is finding what they're fascinated in and saying, that's awesome. Have you thought about this with that? What about this? You know, you should try this. And really encouraging them to get there. And encouraging a specialty, I think, is always a good idea. You know, really getting herbalists and really getting students and herbalists to grasp a specialty. And a fun one is, you know, don't be afraid to let time go within a library. Most of you are already bibliophiles, and that's okay. You know, where we live, if you ever come to the D.C. area, we have the National Library of Medicine, and we have the Library of Congress, and both of them have old, old books. I mean, there's a specific diagnosis by Samuel Thompson that has his own writing in the margins. There's so many old books and so many beautiful books. Going to the Lloyd Library in Cincinnati, you know, just spending time of, you know, flipping through even your own books, or if you don't live near any of these, looking through Google Books. Scudder's specific diagnosis is available on Google Books for free. And so, you know, flipping through, especially historical books, but just letting yourself get lost in these books is such a wonderful way to learn, not necessarily just going in with the quest of I need to find a particular piece of information, but just looking at what you have and what's in front of you and, you know, what you might be able to explore looking at it. So the last couple as far as being an educator. As a teacher, be prepared to be surpassed in skill and be delighted when it happens. Students surpass my skill in certain areas all the time. I present case studies where I think I, you know, did some brilliant job and everything was amazing, and yet they'll come up with better ideas than I will. And so, you know, as an educator or as a student, a lot of times, you know, don't be afraid to challenge things. Don't be afraid to add in to what you're already learning. You know, let students question you. It's so healthy to be questioned because, you know, you have your way of doing it. And as herbalists, we all do it so many different ways. You know, to ask 10 herbalists how they dose the same plant, and you're going to get different answers. And it doesn't necessarily mean that one's right or one's wrong. It certainly doesn't mean that. But the question is why, and understanding their rationale and questioning why that's right is so effective to do that. And the last one in this that I think is such a powerful place for herbalists is very much for herbalists to be a catalyst for change. And I think herbalists can be a catalyst for change in just about every way. It's something that we do well. I don't know if it's because we're like alchemists or it's because we see connections between things or if it's because we know, you know, that plants are both chemistry and magic. But we can catalyze change in the world around us, in the people around us. And so, you know, figuring out how to best catalyze that change, how to help people see possibilities, how to, you know, use whatever skills you have, whether it's plants or language or both, to catalyze change in an individual, in a community, and whether that's a plant community, a people community, any type of community. But thinking about how you can create change and what tools you have, I think herbalists are really good at that. You know, where I work at MUIH, I think they're always wondering why the herbalists are shaking things up. You know, we tend to come up with these new or radical ideas a lot and try to have people understand them or, you know, try to expand people's ideas or change their minds on things. And so I think that expansiveness of herbalists is something that we do incredibly well, is be a catalyst for change. So herbalists as plant people. Of course, we are plant people. I mean, that's what we are, and it's hard to separate us out from any of that. You know, it's something that I love so much about us as a connection as plant people. A favorite story about this is, you know, I travel around the world, and I've been all sorts of places and connected with herbalists. I remember flying to New Zealand, and in this particular place, I was able to get a name and an address and email somebody, and they invited us to come when we landed from our flight because they live not too far away, a few hours away. So, you know, we landed after a very long travel, traveled to this person's house, and kind of got there in this new land, and she just looked at me and said, you know, gave me a big hug and was like, welcome. And she said, I was just on my way out to the yard to, you know, gather some wild herbs for a salad. Would you like to help? And so there I was, you know, as a plant person, gathering chickweed just a few moments after I arrived there. And I loved that. So, you know, we are plant people, and it connects us around the globe. If you're a plant person, you really never have that, you're never alone in many ways. That's probably one of the ones I was going to talk about. But for me, I've noticed a big difference also in connection with plants. And I grew up in the country. I moved to the city for quite a while, and now I live back in the country, and I'm surrounded by plants. And those plants are powerful medicines, just being in my community and acknowledging, you know, my role as a plant person in general. So, know medicines like your friends, and be okay if they aren't necessarily the type you want to get romantic with. For me, this is you know, I always think of plants as like, there's plants that I'm lovers with, there's plants that I'm family with, there's plants that I'm friends with or colleagues or even friends, you know, colleagues. I don't really have any arch enemy plants, I don't think. But there's definitely ones I connect with. And I'll have like love affairs with plants or, you know, or I'll have times when, you know, that I'll have a quick love affair and then I'm a little disenchanted or something. So, and then somebody will turn me on to the plants again. So, I love that we could have these medicines that way. If you know, I think all of us find ourselves migrating to plants. How many herbs should we know is a question people often ask. I think that we should know 5 plants. I think it's great to have a working knowledge of 30 plants. I think it's wonderful to know 200 plants and to be familiar with, as many as you can. But, you know, to really know 5 plants, that's fantastic. And so, you know, we need to think about how we know these plants. Are they regional for us? Are they essential for us? Do we just have a connection with them? I love watching students develop their plant connections because they always, you know, in clinics, they always seem to find a reason why people need a certain plant that they have a connection with. So, you know, go ahead and let yourself gravitate towards plants. Learn, and when there's others that gravitate towards plants, find out about why does that person like that plant so much. I mean, there's some plants that some people like them so much, every time I see them, I think about an individual, and that's lovely. So, you know, really think about how we can embrace our plant favorites. And I think it would be good fun, wouldn't it? And we will probably never do it, but wouldn't it be fun to have a conference theme where every herbalist comes and just talks about their favorite plants and why that was their favorite plants. We did a lecture for a fundraiser the other night called Only 5 Herbs, and it was 4 of us actually, but we were each talking about, you know, if we had only one herb to choose, what herb would we choose? I got to cover 2. I was really lucky. But and they were yarrow and garlic, by the way, if you're wondering. So how do you choose those plants? And knowing that it's okay if somebody's like, oh, my gosh, I think, you know, albizia is the best plant I've ever used. And you're thinking, well, why? You know, I have never really connected with it. Tell me about it. So people and plants very much share the same language. We mentioned this in the beginning, the product of co-evolution, people and plants evolving together, growing together, and changing together. Herbs speak in many ways, and your physiology listens. When people ask how I first got into herbs, I have a lot of answers for that. I mean, if you stalk, you know, more publicly appropriate answers. But a lot of it was just, you know, a calling for me through dreams and otherwise. But then part of it was also plants, experiencing plants that had a strong effect on my physiology. And realizing, you know, other than that being kind of cool and feeling interesting, how profound that was, that I had receptor sites in my body for plants. And knowing that I did nutritionally, but really thinking about how that's possible. And this is a great way to turn people onto plants. When, you know, talking to them about how interesting it is that, you know, we have really 5-ish plants, a few more, plants that have caffeine-like alkaloids in the world. And think about the fact that your body has a receptor site that those caffeine-like alkaloids can bind to, and that your body can speak the same language of that plant, or that language can speak directly to your body. People understand caffeine, and they know it does something, so that's a great way to look at it. But, you know, really understanding the language that people are speaking and understanding the language that a plant is speaking, and when you can put those two together, that's when you end up with herbal medicine. And the more that you can understand them, both of them, the better. So we tend to, as herbalists, think a lot about, you know, people will be like, oh, I heard about this rare herb from Africa, and it's supposed to be, you know, a cure for Lyme disease or something. You know, there's probably some rare herbs that are cures for something, but oftentimes our medicines are very plentiful. They aren't always, of course, and that's why groups like United Plant Savers exist to create awareness around it. But in many ways, rare plants do not equal better plants by any means. You need to know how to use what's around you, even if there's a better medicine. So yeah, I mean, none of us want to practice without cinnamon and ginger and plants like that, but definitely, unless somebody's calling in from somewhere much more exciting, aren't plants that are just all around them. But maybe you should know how to use, you know, your tulip poplar or your dogwood bark or your, you know, sassafras or whatever it is that's actually growing all around you that may not be the first herb that people would go to for medicine. Your bidens, you know, who knows what, whatever, your agrimony. Knowing how to use those herbs can be very useful because knowing what's around you is powerful. So learn the plants that are around you. And then the best place, I think, to find out esoteric information is actually to go historical. So go onto a website like Henriette's Herbal or look in King's American Dispensatory, which you can find on Henriette's Herbal, King's American Dispensatory, and look for those plants. I've found all sorts of plants, but I had no idea that anybody used, you know, Vernonia ironweed for medicine. And then you find out, you know, it's not something I'd buy or import, but it's certainly something, if it's growing right in my field, that I might, you know, be happy and willing to use it. So know the herbs that are right around you and right outside your window. At the same time, remember that there's a whole Materia Medica in grocery stores, and I think this is a class that I would love to do at some point, Materia Medica of the grocery store, because you're going to talk with clients that are all over the place that don't know herbs, they don't know how to get herbs. The only place they can buy herbs is Walmart, where they live, and they need medicine. So I would so much rather send them to the grocery store. Garlic, ginger, parsley, lemongrass, rosemary, thyme, basil, sage, lemons, limes, leeks, shallots, onions, cabbages, apples, all of these can be used as medicines. They are all medicines in various ways. So learning how to use those grocery store medicines, they're cheap, they're culturally acceptable, they're highly available for people. Sometimes they're significantly inexpensive compared to other things. So really, knowing how to use your grocery store as a medicine is great. Of course, knowing how to use your outdoor pharmacy is even better, but that's a whole stepping stone. You know, when somebody calls you on the phone and is having some kind of respiratory issue, you're not going to be like, okay, you got to get a field guide, go outside, you know, start trying to recognize things. You might be able to ask them, do you know what goldenrod looks like? Great, let's get that. Do you have any garlic? But you can send them to the store to get all sorts of things, and that's a really, you know, a fun way to learn how to use your grocery store Materia Medica. I will hear that, you know, a lot of the powdered herbs are also another great way to have people use medicine. So knowing what's in people's spice cabinets, although the quality of what's in people's spice cabinets is often so historical, but knowing what's going to be in there and having that, you know, kind of Materia Medica list of what you can get around someone's house, in someone's yard, in their common flower bed, without them having to, like, go out and buy some valerian capsules or something like that. And to know your plants inside and outside your body, I educate a lot of pharmacists, and they think I'm completely insane that I take everything that I use. And it's really good that I'm not a pharmacist, because I definitely wouldn't want to be in that situation where, you know, I'm popping all the pills that I would be recommending. But as an herbalist, use all of your plants. Sit with them, each one of them individually. I remember when I was a young teenager and I started Rosemary Gladstar's correspondence course, and she would have you, you know, read about herbs in 4 books and then taste them. And I'd brew myself a pot of tea, and I'd read from, you know, Michael Tierra's Way of Herbs and John Lust's The Herb Book and Back to Eden and I can't remember what the last one was, but those were basically the herb books that were common and around at that point. And so I would, you know, read about each herb while I was drinking the pot of tea and just understand it. And those lessons are still with me. I don't literally have them. I remember those were on a bunch of note cards. Maybe I do have them. But they're still with me to this day. And that also means, you know, knowing plants inside your body, out in nature, you know, tasting them, but also knowing plants outside your body. You know, that could be topically, but also sitting with them, finding them, and getting to know them, meeting them. You know, as an herbalist, for me, I've met most of the medicines that I use, and it's so exciting when I get to meet a new one. I remember meeting cloves for the first time a year and a half ago, and just being over the moon, meeting cloves, you know, that I held the branch of the tree and nibbled on the buds that were right there on the tree, these buds, and it was like this explosion in my mouth. I mean, you had to spit it out very quickly, those fresh clove buds. It was so much volatile oil, but just kind of, it's like meeting an old friend. So getting to know your plants as much as you can, which is why those local medicines are so incredibly important. And this is last, but certainly not least, the idea of, really understanding that, nature has such incredible wisdom and that it's our greatest teacher. So when I'm talking about nature, I'm not meaning, natural is better and I don't want to learn about science. Science is nature. Physiology is nature. Botany is nature. Spirit is nature. I mean, really, all of these things are. So, I often look to nature for examples. Like, believing that nature is wise, believing physiology is wise, believing the body's choices are wise. Believing that a client that has a disease, that it's that the body was given parameters that it had to exist within, and it made a choice. And this was the best choice for it to make. Watching, plants and how they react in people's bodies. Harnessing that wisdom of nature is one of the first key pieces of all of this. Like, you don't really have to understand how something works in a body, although it's wonderful too, but what you can know is that you're going to be able to use millions of years of evolution of nature to be able to be your medicine. And I think about what an uphill battle it is for newer arts of medicine like conventional pharmacy. Literally, although some of those are based on plants, but literally some of these just have to be created. And then they have to figure out, like, what they do in people's bodies and what's safe and how this works. Whereas with plants, it's, these things, it's like harvesting. It's just a question of harvesting these relationships that already exist, of utilizing this, the evolutionary forces of nature to, really scoop up the potential and apply it to a different difficult situation. So plants have wisdom that far exceeds what we'll ever be able to understand because they are, they're living beings, and we have a living medicine, which is absolutely, profound to be able to use a living thing as medicine and to be able to have it, do its way. So I think that understanding herbs, it can be so easy to think when you're studying the phytochemistry and pharmacology or the inner workings of botany or how it actually works in the body, that you're taking away the magic. But in many ways, I think you're adding to the magic because you're just scratching the surface of what we understand. I mean, we don't even understand photosynthesis. We understand a lot of it, but there's still pieces that we don't quite understand about it, or we would be doing that all the time. We would be able to think of how much energy plants get from the sun. It's absolutely remarkable. So tonight, the idea was to, kind of take you on a story of the things that that I've learned and the lessons that I want to share in my first 20 years of doing this. It doesn't mean that they're the lessons for you, but these are things that as a teacher, as a mother, as an herbalist, as a clinician, as a friend, that I've come to realize. And I hope some of these were important for some of you, and we have some time now that I'd be happy to discuss any topics that you felt like were interesting to discuss, any particular questions that you have about philosophy or background or whatever that is. So I'm going to go ahead and let Stephen interject some questions. Before I do that, I wanted to make sure that I showed this last slide, which is for the American College of Healthcare Sciences as well as a sponsor. So, I'm switching hats for just a quick moment and letting you know that as the vice president of the HG, that the webinars that we offer are now sponsored. So, Maryland University of Integrative Health, where I'm employed, and also the American Colleges, the College of Healthcare Sciences, which was formerly Australasian. These two great institutions are sponsoring tonight's webinar. So I'll go back to taking questions now.
All right, Beth. Wonderful. Thank you for sharing all of your insights. It's always nice to see what kindred souls we are as herbalists, because I relate to much of what you said. Someone asked, we haven't had a lot of questions typed in, so people, please feel free to submit your questions, but someone asked, could you type into the chat box? You mentioned some herbal articles and websites to read, and they were asking if you could type some of those into the chat box so they could actually see how they're spelled out. So, and you might want to just, you know, repeat the names when you do that.
So when I type into the chat box, Stephen, I just see the send chat to staff.
There's a little arrow that drops down so you can send it to the entire audience.
That's not an option for me.
Oh, it's not an option?
No.
Oh, okay. You'll have to. Maybe you'll have to.
Okay. Well, I'll send them to you, and you can.
And I'll have to try to send them to the entire audience. Okay. Okay. Here's a good question. What are some good ways to gain clinical skills and clinical experiences if there are no herbalists in one's community?
Okay. Well, there's a lot of online programs. So that's the first thing I would say. You know, both of the sponsoring universities tonight, the American College of Health Sciences and Maryland University of Integrative Health, both have online programs. There are so many more, you know, everything from Rosemary Gladstar's program to Juliet Blankenspor's Chestnut Herbs is launching one more about growing. You know, so I would say what you want to figure out is what do you want to learn? So if you're looking for like a degree program, then that's going to send you in a totally different direction than if you are just looking to educate yourself for your own community. So if there's no clinicians and you're looking for clinical training, the AHG also has a mentorship program. And so you can contact the AHG office and find that out. There's also a lot of herb conferences that you can travel to around the country. So there's a lot of, we are a community that's very spread out. You should be able to find quite a few resources. And on the AHG website, you can see a list of, there's a school's directory as well that you can download that school's directory and find out more about those schools and what they're offering.
Okay. What is the title of the book that started with King's? I think it was the King's Dispensary, wasn't it?
King's American Dispensatory. I can type that.
Yeah, I'll type that. It went in. I know it. King's American Dispensatory. I don't know if I spelled dispensatory.
And that's on Henriette's Herbal. You can find that on Henriette's Herbal, which is just Google Henriette's Herbal, and that will come up.
Okay. Let's see. What was your typical fee structure for long-term clients, especially for follow-up visits? Assuming that a client can afford your fee.
Yeah, so I love these kind of specific questions because I wasn't sure if people really wanted to hear those kinds of things. So it's varied tremendously over time. When I was first practicing, I think I was charging $80 an hour in Boston, and I was charging $40 an hour in Maine. That's changed dramatically to most recently at the Maryland University of Integrative Health, I was charging $140 for an initial consultation and $85 for a follow-up. Usually I'm actually charging about $1 a minute to $1.25 a minute. But I have to say that right now, because I have all these great students and free clinical services all around and there's an abundance of herbalists, I would charge more if I was to be practicing at the moment in private practice. I have a one-year-old, so I've kind of taken this 1 year off. So if I was going to be seeing people on a daily basis now, I'd probably charge more after I told them where they could get much cheaper, really excellent services, so if they specifically wanted to work with me. That said, I will add that I have clients right now that that are old clients that I've had for many years that kind of pay me a yearly retainer, I would say, that they send me so much money per year, and I kind of have an ongoing relationship, so we don't even have these. It might even be via email, or we'll check in a couple times a year. But I'm just there to help answer questions, adjust things, keep things going for them. So I'm really flexible. And I think one of the key pieces with fee structures is often offering packages. So, charging less for the third or charging less if they do all three visits, because you really need to see people three times. And I think being upfront in the beginning and saying, you're not obligated to, but you should expect to come in three times. And that our work is going to be most effective if you give me these three visits, usually over the course of about 3 weeks. Usually the first visit, second visit a week later, and a third visit 2 weeks later. But it depends on what they're working on. It doesn't necessarily have to be that way. So, you know, if you're in a large city, I think you can charge much more than that. Whatever you charge, you just need to feel totally like you're worth it. Because people, if you say, well, it's 185 an hour, is that okay? You know, people are like, whoa, what's going on with that? So, you know, you really need to have the confidence to just say, this is how much I charge, and go with there.
Can I tell you a little thing I tell people? Mm-hmm. At the very least, you should look at what a massage therapist in your area charges for an hour massage.
That's great.
I mean,
really good.
You're worth at least as much as a massage therapist, right?
Right. Yep, absolutely.
So, okay, this is a really good question. How do you maintain your authority as a teacher when students surpass you in knowledge and experience?
Ah, what a great question. Well, they don't surpass me in experience. So that's one of the things. They surpass me in knowledge. No, they don't surpass me in knowledge usually either. They surpass me in good ideas and in innovation, I would say. So that's probably one of the big things, is that I have, you know, a lot more knowledge and history with certain things, but they have, you know, I would say every student is an expert in a certain area more than you are. Maybe they've had a health condition, maybe they've, you know, gone through something. So you're not trying to be the utmost authority, as much as I have to look at myself when I get to be a certain point in my teaching. So, you know, with 3 years of students, by the time they're in their third year, I am a guide. And my job as a guide is to help them to find the answers that they need to find. And so, you know, when I'm sitting next to a student and they're seeing a client, I'm not going to say, you know, oh, I have the perfect herbs for this client. It's often, you know, what do you think? And then if they come up with an idea thinking, is it good enough that I'm going to let them go with it? Or is it awesome? You know, sometimes I'm just looking and I'm like, that is a damn good idea. And other times I'm like, yeah, well, I think, you know, maybe that's a little astringent for this client or so on. So again, you know, I think that it's such a great question, but students surpass me in their creativity all the time. And that's really where it comes out, their creativity. And oftentimes it is skill. But it's not knowledge. It might be skill in a certain area that they've focused on.
This is kind of an odd question to me, but I think it should address it. Someone's asking about herbal books for non-hybrid herbs, and I wasn't aware we had all that big of a problem with hybrid herbs.
Yeah, I mean, the mints, they're like crazy hybrids. You know, they're breeding with one another all over the place. But all of your lemon, palm, and mints and all that, you know, they can get all crazy. But otherwise, no, I have no idea.
Yeah. Do you get herbs wholesale and charge clients retail?
Ooh, so I'm going to shake things up a little bit here and probably piss some people off. I think that if I was – so I practice at the university, and we have a dispensary that, like, custom formulates and blah, blah, blah. So I – practice without making money off my medicine. I think, although I think herbalists should still do it, I think there's a profound conflict of interest with herbalists making money off of selling products and making their own products. I just, you know, I'm not saying you shouldn't do it, because if I wasn't at NUH, I would probably be doing it too. But it's the reason why physicians aren't allowed to own stock in drug companies. There is something to be said for this. And so while most of us, it's like, well, what's wrong with doing that? Of course, you're just, you know, sharing quality products and, like, supporting your community and making your way as an herbalist. But there is, you know, selling medicine, there's a lot of questionable ethics out there. And I'm sure we've all seen it in people that are sold $600 worth of supplements that they absolutely have to have, when that's really not true. So that was my little rant. We, at MUIH, we definitely buy our herbs, and we buy them from all sorts of different suppliers. They're all organic or ethically wildcrafted. So we definitely use people like Mountain Rose. We use some smaller suppliers that are growers. We use a variety of different types of tincture makers. And And, you know, we make some of our own, but we go through a pretty high volume. So I think, you know, buying your herbs is great. There's a lot of great herb companies out there. You know, if you can afford to, I think it's wonderful to support companies like Zach Woods Herb Farm. I don't know if you can type that, Stephen, Zach Woods Herb Farm, or Healing Spirits in Avoca, New York, because both of Zach Woods and Healing Spirits are just small micro herb companies, or whoever's local in your area in your farmer's market. Oh, I should say, I mentioned powders a lot. You need to buy powders.
Well, that's a question I was just going to ask you.
Yeah, you got to buy those powders.
This person says, you mentioned herb powders. I sprinkle the powders on food or add them to my smoothies, but my clients are uncomfortable with this method. They want specific doses in capsules and tinctures. So.
Good. Oh, thank you. That's such a good question. So, okay, powders. You got to buy them because they're gritty if you do them in a coffee grinder or whatever. You need to have a hammer mill. And so usually, unless you have a hammer mill, most people need to buy them from someplace like Mountain Rose or whatever, which is where we buy ours. We use gram dosages for powders, and we all, just like we use milliliters for tinctures, we use grams for powders. And so, like, a typical daily dose of powders is 3 to 5 grams, which, by the way, is the equivalent of like 8 to 10 capsules, roughly, 6 to 12 capsules, whatever you want to say. And so. What we do is I would actually, in the dispensary, they would weigh out a bag with 5 grams of that herb in it, just a little baggie, and that person would take that home, and that's their dosage bag. So they would pour that maybe into a teaspoon and see what that looked like and then approximate that every day or pour it into something. So every day they're getting the same amount as that dosage baggie had. You can also tell people to take a teaspoon of the powders. And specifically how, whether, you're going to mix it into nut butter balls. I will have people take home a 2-week batch of powder, make a nut butter ball from a recipe, using like, you know, nut or seed butters, and if they want to add a little honey or whatever, and the herbs, and then divide that into 14 equal size balls, and then eat one a day. So that's another way they can approximate the dose. So those are different ways that they can do that, but powders, I mean, some people aren't compliant with powders and they want tinctures or teas, but other people are very compliant, and I think you need to specifically tell them exactly how much to take and give them that much.
That's great. So someone says, so your income besides teaching gifts is from your consult fees, not from selling products, right?
Well, me, at the moment, my income is that I'm a professor at NUIH.
Yes.
So, you know, so I teach. I mean, I'm an educator. If you are a clinician, you know, I mean, I'm just saying, like, that we, as the herb community, we should just be aware that this exists. I think most herbalists should still make their own medicines, and I think they should sell it to their clients. But I think they should be aware of the ethics of doing so, and maybe while they do it, to let their clients know they can get this otherwise. And also that you'll teach them how to make it if they would like to make it. And I think that kind of covers our butt a little bit versus saying, like, if you want to get better, you have to buy these $600 worth of herbs to do this. And so, yeah, you know, ideally, I think, an herbalist wouldn't necessarily make all their money or too much money from selling stuff. I will say when I used to sell things because I got tired of people not knowing which supplements to buy, I don't use a lot of supplements, but if I was going to recommend them, I started getting them wholesale and selling them wholesale. So that was something that I did do. I didn't make any money off of it, but I did sell them in my practice at one point. And I used a small company, something similar to like Mortar and Pestle Apothecary, where they would formulate it and send it out for me. So everybody has their own model, and I think medicine making is a hugely important part of our practices. And I think it would be a great world if we had so many apothecaries and people making money making medicine, and then so many people making money as clinicians that it supported all of us doing our respective arts.
That would be wonderful, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
What kind of job spaces would be good to get into to expand your knowledge and skills in the herbal field?
What kind of what?
Job things would you get into?
Like what kind of jobs would you want to get?
Yeah.
Well, I think anything that gets you in the door where you want to be is great. You know, if you want to be in industry, try to get a job in industry. If you want to be a clinician, even see if you can volunteer or observe, whether it's at your local, like, WIC, where there's, you know, people doing dietary counseling, or in a doctor's office or something like that. offer your services up for free. I got into a lot of doctor's offices by offering to teach a class on stress management. And so things like that that can be very simple. You know, I would say if you have the skill, whatever your skills are, ask people around you, what is your gift? And if it's speaking, start talking to people. You know, see if every health club will let you set up a free table where you're just going to tell people about herbs, bring some funky-looking things and stick a reishi mushroom on your table and tell them about it. I think health food stores can be very challenging because you're really tied as to what you can actually say to people. But that can be good, too, because you'll get familiar with what's on the market. Whatever you do, just try to find something that's peripheral. Learn how to research is a great thing. If you can learn how to research writers and researchers for herbs, that's something that's, often in demand. So figure out where your passion is and then figure out how that works into it.
This is a good question, too. How can an herbalist in private practice form alliances with health professionals?
I think by being respectful and being professional. So I currently have a nutrition license, but I didn't up until very recently. And I got that nutrition license through being an herbalist, basically. It's a whole other story. But the way that I developed relationships with healthcare professionals was through my clients and through being, very professional and getting in touch with them and asking, writing a letter or something and asking if they have any questions or any concerns that I'd be happy to address them in person. And I think a lot of doctors are very fearful about herbalists because they're afraid that they're either going to be disrespectful about what the doctor's recommending and counter their recommendations, or that they're going to do something unsafe. So if they realize the channel of communication is open and that you're professional and that you are concerned about safety to the extent that would help them to feel comfortable, then I think that they're much more likely to be open to it. You may even want to talk to, your own doctor. But I find getting out there and talking to people and then being as professional as possible and just feeling like you're a peer with them, also getting a specialty. And I think that's, being a generalist is a great thing, but within that, you may also want to find a way that you can really hone your skills and specialize on something in particular that is of medical relevance. So, it could be like ophthalmology or it could be, who knows what it could be. If you do that, you're going to be able to relate more to the people in the field because you'll need to speak their language a little bit. And learning that medical language is hard. And that's something, that takes a long time for my students to learn. But once they learn it, they can speak to a professional about pathophysiology or so on or the way herbs work, and it's really helpful.
You kind of mentioned this in passing. Someone is asking about what the best kind of grinder was to make the powders.
Hammer mill.
Hammer
it's
mill.
It's not something, people don't buy hammer mills. Usually they're like big things.
They're probably pretty expensive, right?
I think they're very expensive. So you can powder your own herbs with a coffee grinder, but a lot of them are not going to be silky smooth, which is really what people are looking for.
Okay. What about liability insurance?
So you can actually get, through the American Herbalist Guild, you can get liability insurance. It's amazing. We're unlicensed, which is fantastic. And you can get liability insurance. It's very inexpensive. I think it's about $120 a year or so. So check that out through the – it's not through the HG. We just have a relationship with I think it's the American Acupuncture Council that offers the insurance. But go on the HG website.
Yep, I thought we did, so I just thought that was a good thing to make a plug for the AHG.
Yep, absolutely.
Okay. With the gluten epidemic, there seem to be many people who have paradoxical reactions to both medicines and herbs. Do you have any experience with healing the blood-brain barrier with herbs or foods? Although I think that's more the gut barrier that's the problem. But anyway, comment.
But. Yeah, I think herbs are really good at helping your body to restore health, no matter how complicated whatever it is going on. I mean, I often say that you can have the most complicated health condition that's existing, and if you help their nervous system to be calm and their digestive system to work well, then they start moving towards health. That's not always true, but a lot of times that's what you need. And so I think, you know, our people's sensitivities in general are very heightened right now, and it's one of the reasons why herbs are such wonderful medicine, because they can be so subtle. And so using, so I think herbs can be very helpful in healing the gut and then helping the body. I don't think there's any herbs that are going to directly heal some kind of neurological breach, blood-brain barrier impact, but I think the body can heal from something like that if it has all of its needs met adequately, and that's what herbs can do.
Yep. Can you post, this would be a little more tricky, but can you post websites for the herb companies that you're talking about, or maybe we just mention them? And can you dehydrate your own herbs and use coffee grinders? You've already mentioned you can use coffee grinders, but obviously you can dehydrate your own herbs too. But what are some of the companies that you recommend for getting the organic herbs again?
So I'm typing some of them out.
Okay.
And I can also, if there's something you don't, whoops, that was Avoca New York, actually, on Healing Spirits, Stephen. So Zach Woods, those are some companies I really like. And Mountain Rose, of course, but they're like a big company. So if you want to go with a small company, you can really, I mean, the herbs, it's just like the difference between buying organic produce from your grocery store or Whole Foods versus buying it from a farmer, the difference between something like Zach Woods and a larger company. So really, they're pretty amazing companies.
Okay. I typed those all in the chat to everybody.
Great.
So, yeah.
You can always, if there's something, you can just email me too. If they, you know, I can certainly respond to a quick question via email. Maybe not tonight, but at some point.
Okay. Two final questions because we're really out of time. How would you go about assessing an online program, or educational program?
Well, I think that there's a few ways to do that. The experience of the faculty would be one. You know, I think one of the first places you would look is, do you want a degree? Because then it needs to be accredited. And who is it accredited by? So I think that's, you know, if you're looking for a degree, then make sure it's regionally accredited, the same way like any university is accredited. And then if it's, so beyond that, if you're not looking for a degree, then, and you know, if it is accredited, there's certain standards it has to uphold. If you're not looking for a degree, I would ask, you know, do you see a sample lesson? I would, you know, talk to them about what you're looking at, and I would ask reputation, like ask around, you know, go on Facebook and maybe ask about things in some of the forums that are online. There's an herb student forum that's a Yahoo group that's also very popular, and that's a good place to ask. So you can actually go onto Yahoo and type in herb student and find that group. So I would ask around and see what people have to say. There's so many wonderful ones. I hesitate to, you know, kind of list all of them because I wouldn't be able to. But do just check out what's been around for a while and how much it costs and what the experience is of people.
Well, and the good place to start looking, researching them is to go to the AHG website and look at the list of schools and schools that are offered by professional members of the American Herbalist Guild. I mean,
yep.
So
that's a great point. Thank you.
Yeah, since we're both involved with the guild, we might as well put in a plug for it, right?
Might as well plug it, yeah.
And this final question is, in choosing what to charge, do you factor in things like that you can have to spend time researching their meds or you know, do you, in other words, do you charge more if, you know, the case is more complicated, or how do you do that?
So I never charged more if the case is more complicated, but I think you could. Probably more in like a package deal kind of thing, or it may be what you're known for working with. So, you know, somebody like a practitioner I have a lot of respect for, Jonathan Treasure, works with very complicated cases, and so he charges more. But his fee is very, you know, it makes a lot of sense because of the amount of research that he has to do. So consider it an education in some ways that you're getting paid for slightly when you're doing that research, because you'll be able to build on it as you go along. So I don't charge more depending on what is going on for people. But I do acknowledge that sometimes some cases are very high maintenance as far as time goes, and sometimes they're not. as my maintenance.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Okay. Well, we want to get you back to your kids. There was someone who asked about filing taxes, and I suggest you talk to an accountant because I don't think Bevan or I are qualified to give you advice on filing taxes.
I do file taxes. But,
I file taxes too, but I think on advice for filing taxes, I think you should talk to an accountant, not an herbalist, for advice on filing taxes.
It doesn't sound like a very fun question to end on either. My contact information is up there. I hope I meet many of you at the AHG conference in Callaway Gardens in November. Thank you so much for all of your attention tonight, and it's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Bevan, for giving your presentation. It was wonderful.
Thank you.
Goodbye.